What is going on, everyone? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. This is episode 31, and we are talking to John Mark. If you don't know John Mark's stuff, his music, you need to now. He is incredible. He has some incredible music. He's an incredible singer-songwriter. It's good stuff. You should check him out. But the reason that he's on this podcast, first and foremost, is sort of to plug this new album that he has coming out. It's called Smile in the Mystery. And I guess technically it was coming out when we recorded, and now it's out. So lucky for you, you can go and you can pick it up right now. I want to encourage you to check it out. I feel like Christmas music can get so bland to me. And I feel like what John Mark is bringing to the table is a real contribution to the genre. It's a really good album. He has amazing vinyl pressings of this album. If you're into that sort of thing, I would just ask that you check it out and just stream it. All the time. Just stream it and support. Pick his stuff up. I will make sure that all that's in the show notes below. This is a great interview. He is a really fun guy. We talk about music. We talk about his origin story. We even talk about gangster rap. We get to nerd out about that for a while. So you do not want to miss that conversation. It gets real. So it's a great interview. You're going to love it. So make sure you're subscribed in iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from. If you want to, go ahead and give me a rating and review on that. That helps get the word out about the Theology of Hustle. And it tells people that, you know, actual normal people listen to this. I'm not just some weirdo just speaking into a microphone at home. So I would greatly appreciate that. Again, make sure that you follow John Mark on all of his socials, just so you know what's coming out. Be sure you let me know what you think on social media, and I hope you enjoy this interview with John Mark. Well, hey, John Mark, I really appreciate you jumping on this call with me. I really appreciate it. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, man, it's good to meet you too.
Why don't we just jump off here and have you tell people a little bit about yourself, what you do, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so my name is John Mark, and I'm an artist from Charlotte, North Carolina, and I write songs, and then we record the songs, and then we tour. We make records out of the songs, and we tour the songs.
I know it
sounds so, but that all sounds so whatever. But that's what we do, you know.
Yeah,
that's literally what we do. I sit around and try and think of things to sing about, and then I try and write songs that hopefully, you know, are interesting. And then we try and record them in interesting ways, and then we go tour, and then we do it all again. But so that's kind of that's the technical.
Yeah,
yeah, I like that. Yeah. I like that. I feel like sitting around trying to think up songs is pretty sweet, right?
Yeah, yeah, it is. Well, yeah. It is. It's really frustrating too, you know, because I spend a lot of time sitting around thinking like, who the heck cares about what I'm about to sing about? You know, like, why does a song need to be sung about what I'm about to sing? So, yeah. So it's a lot of fun, but it's not a party all the time for sure. It's a lot of staring at the wall and thinking like, why? You know.
Yeah.
The creative process is tricky anyway, but I feel like to tie it to your vocation and your income, that's like the next level of tricky, right? Isn't it?
It is tricky. It's the same kind of tricky, just on a different level, though. So early on, you're like, you're limited to, you know, like, I've got to have an instrument. I guess I can sing without an instrument, but generally you need an instrument. So, you know, what kind of instrument can I afford? I've got to figure out how to get an instrument and a reason to have an instrument. And then if the instrument, you know, my early guitars, you know, they would only stay in tune at certain places of the guitar. So I'm stuck in certain keys. So I can either choose to be creative in those keys, or I can just not play. You know what I mean? And I feel like as it continues, it's sort of like, okay, well, are we going to take the light show on the road this year? Or are we going to take an extra keyboard player? You know, like, it's sort of like there's always compromise. To me, like, compromise is almost the, let me put it this way, your limitations are actually springboards for creativity, you know? And so, yeah, when it becomes your vocation, that it's limited in another way. Like, all of a sudden, you're like, yeah, if people don't buy this, I don't have a job anymore. And, like, I get to make expensive records. I put $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 in a record, you know, which is awesome. Awesome, because if I want the good organ player from across the country, I can have, you know, he or she. If I want background vocals from my friends in New York, I can have them. Yeah. You know, like, I have a budget. It's not unlimited, but, like, it's nice. And so, like, I get to create this work that's, like, really exciting. Now, I can create exciting work without the organ player, without the string guy, without, you know, the extra stuff. But, man, it's nice to have all those colors in your palette that you can pull from. That only exists because people are willing to stream my records. I say buy, but we hope people will stream them enough for it to continue to be valuable enough for me to pull from all these places. But, like, for me, that's the big issue about, like, being vocation. It's like, this has to continue to be my job, or my budgets for records go away. And then I'll continue to make music, but I can't make it the way I'm making it now. So there's that, there's always that limitation, you know, is always part of the conversation. And, you know, limitations, I think, actually help. In fact, sometimes we make rules in the studio, like, all right, no cymbals on this record. No, you know, no guitar on this record or whatever, you know, like, it helps because you have all these decisions. So I know I'm rabbit trailing at
this
point.
This is awesome. You know, I love talking about this.
Yeah, vocation becomes another limitation in the sense that, like, all right, well, I can do whatever I want now because I can afford it. But if people don't like it, then I won't be able to continue to afford it. So then how much do I have to think about what people like versus what I want to do? It's sort of like you're never an island. You're never creatively just on your own in a corner. It's always connected. But that's what art is. Like, art doesn't exist by itself. You know, like, art is created to be seen and to be heard, because the nature of art is sort of, to me, like, art, music, all this stuff is really the practice of sort of not being alone, you know? And so if there's no one to see your work, I mean, I guess you could be the person who sees or hears your work, but work is created to be experienced by a person, whether that person is just you later on, or God, or hopefully. But I mean, let's be honest, we're all dreaming that someone is going to see it and experience it and feel the way you hopefully feel the way you felt when you made it, right? Yeah. So that's always there, and it's never not there. Yeah, so the vocation can be tricky, because then, you know, there is this side of it too, is you start making good money and you're like, man, I really, like, you, it's funny how many people I run into who make really good money and they have these really big record budgets, but they tell me, man, I wish I could do what you do. You know,
how so?
Well, because they don't think their audience is going to like it. And they're sort of, you know, if I was going to be negative about it, I could say, well, they're addicted to this lifestyle. But that's not true. We all are addicted to our lifestyles. But, you know, they've got a staff. They have people who work for them. They've got things they have to keep going. And, you know, if they don't do things a certain way, people stop buying their records, stop listening to them on the radio. They don't have the same amount of money they've got to, like, you know. So it really is interesting. Vocation. Being successful in your artistic vocation can be both a challenge and it can be a resource, you know. But the challenge never goes away. It only changes. The challenge is always there. The limitation is always there. It never disappears, you know. And then I think in those rare cases where it does disappear, you kind of become your own limitation, you know. And you're like, I don't know what to sing about anymore, you know. And that's, you know, like, if you won, I think all the time about, I would kind of hate to win the lottery, because I don't think I'd have what it takes to turn that money down. But then I'd be like, I have nothing to sing about anymore.
I won the lottery.
Like, my life is so disconnected. After a very short period of time, my life is so disconnected from everyone else's that I don't think I have anything to write that anyone else is going to care to listen to. You know, so you become the limitation in that sense, right? So it's always there, and it's always... it's always a puzzle, and that's what makes it exciting, right? It never is not a challenge. Ever.
Yeah, dude. yeah, that's good stuff, man. I really appreciate that. I think it's really cool because it's like a whole different realm than I've ever really talked to, you know? Yeah. It's cool. So But I want to go back down the road. I want to go down your road. So, you know, back in the day when you were just getting started, you know, playing guitar and stuff, how did you get started in the world of music? Yeah, yeah. Like, what did that road look like for you from the beginning?
Okay. So if you want to go way back, I remember I was probably 14, 15 years old, and a friend was coming over to the house. I hadn't seen him in a little while. And, you know, back in those days, we talked on the phone. We didn't text. You could email, but you know, you had to sit down at the computer and, you know, so once a day you made check your email, you know, or what's the instant messenger or what is it we used to do? I can't remember, you know, but so, you know, we had been somewhat out of touch, you know, not entirely out of touch, but we talked and, you know, I was like, oh, man, you should come over. And we worked it out. You know, neither of us could drive. So his mom dropped him off, I think. And he got out of the car with a red Squire Stratocaster and a little PV Rage amp.
Yes.
I was like, oh, man. I was like, this is cool. We went upstairs to my room. He plugged it in. And he could play all the songs from the radio. You know, he's playing Nirvana and he's playing Pearl Jam and he's playing REM and he's playing the Counting Crows. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I was like magic. I was like, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Like, a human is making these sounds. I was like, this is so awesome. I was like, and immediately I was like, can you teach me how to do that? You know, because I was not very athletic growing up, and I'd realized real quick sports were not going to be my path. But I thought all of a sudden, and I also realized that I was way into comic books. I love to draw. I was in high school. I don't know if that's. I like to draw, right?
Right.
I realized very quickly, or I was realizing at that time of life, like, this may be my path, but it's not my path to kissing girls. Like, they don't care about, you know, my comic books. So, which is interesting because their girls are into that maybe now, but like back then.
Yeah. Nah, yeah. Nah. I mean, definitely I feel not. Like that's some impressive self-knowledge,
well,
right?
Well, it took a long time. It took me a minute. Well, you get desperate in high school, you know? You're like, I suck at sports. Girls think I'm... No, they didn't really have opinion either way, but it's just the drawings were not helping me.
I get it. I get it. Yeah, you totally. Know? Yeah.
And not that I meant to leave that behind, but, you know, but I did. But I was, all of a sudden in music, I was like, oh, this is my way. And I mean, I don't know that it was even that conscious. Yeah. I just saw it. I was like, I want to be a part of this. This seems like magic. I want to be with this. I want to do music. I want to make magic with my fingers. And so I dug up my dad's old Samick electric guitar and his little amp. And I started buying magazines at the store with tablature in the back.
Yeah.
Learned, you know, Nirvana songs and tried to learn Pearl Jam and REM and all the songs I saw my buddy play.
Yeah.
All the songs that were on the radio and, you know, trying to learn some Eric Clapton licks. And I mean, you know, tried.
Yeah.
You know, but that's how I started playing early on. I just wanted to be a part of bands and I wanted to be a part of that culture and be a part of that world. And I already really loved music, so... then over time, it became something I loved to do, and I tried writing songs here and there, and my dad had a little church for a while we met in a strip shopping mall.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so some of the guys on the worship team, you know, they're a good bit older than me. They all had families and. I mean, shoot, they're all in their 40s. I was like a teenager, you know?
Yeah.
But those guys were so cool. We would sit out in the loading dock and they would teach me classic rock tunes, you know? Like,
that's awesome.
It was awesome. I think everyone was worried about me too. They all thought I had long hair, you know, had the like classic late 90s shaved underneath, like hair down to here.
Yeah.
Wore a nine inch nails t-shirt every single day, N-I-N with a box around it every
day.
Yeah.
Oh, you were a big nine inch nails guy, huh?
I was a big Nine Inch Nails shirt
sure
guy.
Sure guy, sure guy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. It was a legit logo, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was cool. Yeah, honestly,
yeah.
Trent Reznor was doing branding before branding was branding.
Oh,
the guy's
no
a genius.
Doubt. Yeah, for sure.
The guy's a genius. So, yes, they're worried about me. I think they thought I was, you know, into drugs, but I wasn't. just looked.
You had
like
the
it,
look. You know? You had the look. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I remember learning songs, and then I'd write songs. Later on, I went to a ministry school, and in order to be part of the worship team, you had to write your own songs. And so I started writing some songs, tried to write songs, and you know, I don't know that they were very good. But I remember the first time people seemed to notice my songs really was after I went through this breakup. And I remember I was living at a friend's house. His grandmother had moved into assisted living. Oddly enough, it's the same friend who came over with the electric guitar.
There's a lot there, Mark, with that guy, right?
Yeah, he's a great musician, too. You should check his music out. His name is Mark Mathis, and he had a band called Public Radio. You should check out Public Radio, and you should check out Mark Mathis.
Yeah.
He's a great songwriter.
Yeah, will do.
Really, really great. Yep, great artist. But, yeah, I lived with him. His grandmother moved into assisted living, and we stayed at the house to fix it up and make sure it, you know, keep it up. And it's funny. It's around the corner from where I am now. It's not far from where I even live now. I lived at that house, and I didn't have a job for a little while, and my car died. I didn't have a relationship. I had nothing going on, you know? And so I would stay up late at night and write these really sad songs, you know, and sort of like, it became my therapy, you know? I had several seasons like that. And, you know, later on, I had a friend pass away, and it's the same kind of thing. I sort of worked through a lot of that in with songs late at night, you know. But after that, like, people really, not that they loved those songs, some of them maybe, but like after that, people started to really, that's the first time people took notice of my songs. And so I was playing around town, and we had little bands, and I was playing in church, and I was got asked to play some big worship conferences, and I was like, whoa. So I'd never sang my songs in front of more than 100 people. And
wow.
They asked me to come sing at this really big conference. There's probably 5,000 people there, and sing my songs. And oh man, I remember getting up on the stage, and I was so nervous that I stepped up to the mic. I started strumming the chord, and I just couldn't make myself sing. Yeah. I couldn't bring myself to do it. So the background singer started singing the song, and I got to the chorus. I joined in to the chorus, and the whole crowd started singing the chorus, and it was, gosh, one of the most unbelievable feelings I've ever experienced in my whole life. You know, I could feel it in my whole body, which when you do something you're really afraid of, you know, I hear when people run marathons for the first time or people go skydiving or, you know, I'm sure everyone has, I hope people feel that feeling at some point in their life.
Yeah.
You know? But that was it for me. I was like, whoa, I can't believe I just did that.
Yeah.
Like, did we just do that? I guess I did. You
what
know?
Just
I
happened?
I can't believe I did it. I did it poorly. I did it very poorly, but I just did that. I just sang my song, and I heard 5,000 people sing my words back to me.
Wow.
And, you know, I was like, whoa, that was, you know, and so from then on, I think I was like, okay, maybe this is something I can do. Gosh, I can keep going, man. This story is really, really long.
Yeah, I mean, when did you know that this was it? Was it that moment at the conference or, when did you know that this is what you wanted to do?
I never did. I never had that moment. And see, so, and I'll explain. I'm still trying to figure that out.
Okay.
I think we just worked so hard. You know, so in 2006, before 2006, I tried to do music full time and was successful in months at a time, and then I would end up having to go back to work. And then in 2004, I got married. I was like, well, I guess that's kind of done. I'm going to have a regular job.
Right.
And this whole living at your friend's house, living in a basement, living cheap, you know, selling a few CDs is kind of done, I guess, you know. But people kept asking for my songs.
Yeah.
So we would play around town. I'd play at churches and end up playing at conferences. People were like, I want that song. Where can I hear that song? I was like, well, and a lot of times I'd think they were cover songs. I'm like, no, that's mine. And they're like, well, where can I get it? I was like, man, I nowhere, you know? And so people would, record tapes, you know, of me or like bit off the soundboard. I was like, wow, people really want this. So I need to maybe make a record for people to have the songs.
Yeah.
I keep asking for it.
Yeah.
And I never thought like, oh, I'm going to make money off this. I was more like, I don't know how expensive it is to record. I don't know how expensive it is to print. And here's the thing, and I've got a lot to say about this, but just, you know, here's the thing is before we had the technology, like you had to print CDs.
Right.
So, I mean, usually, like, you know, the fewer you printed, the more expensive they were. You could burn them, you know, but then you're talking, what is it? Is a couple bucks a CD?
Yeah, right.
So you burn a few hundred CDs, you're spending like $500-700. Or at that point, you might as well print 1,000, you know,
right.
It could cost you $1,000-1,500 depending on the artwork and all that kind of
right.
stuff. You know,
right.
you had to have that. Now you can just sort of upload it to the internet. It's there. Now there's a downside to that. We can talk about that later, but you know, but I didn't know. I didn't think I was going to make any money.
Yeah.
It really was more about, you know, people wanted the songs. I'm going to record it so they can have the songs. And I liked the way that made me feel, you know.
Yeah.
They needed me for something. They liked me, so I'm going to get them the song. So, and there was no, like, other churches playing your songs or, like, other people hearing your songs and covering them. That was just wasn't in the conversation. I just no thought of that at all. So I recorded my first record and people bought the record. It's like, oh, wow, okay. People buy these. I can go out for a weekend and sell 60, 70, 100 records, CDs sometimes. You
yeah.
know, you're selling $15 a piece. You know, go out on a weekend and make $1,500. It's like, gosh, that's like, wow. So I was able to sail on that for a while, but
yeah.
then that tapered off and then I'm like, back to work. All right, well, back to work. So I got married. Ended up recording another record. People really wanted the songs from this other record that ended up becoming the other record. So I took out a loan, recorded that record. And then around 2006, I was like, well, you know, if I don't give it a shot, I was like, this is the time to do it, if ever.
Yeah.
So my wife and I quit our jobs and we kind of went out on the road. We started calling anywhere that might sell our records. You know, we're like, we'll send you a sample packet with an order form. We created an order form and people would order, you know, bookstores, record stores, churches, anyone we thought might be interested in our music. So we had several who would order, you know, 10, 5, 10, 20 at a time. And so we spent that first 2 weeks just anyone we knew who, you know, we would like, who was in charge of your buying your stuff? And we sent them stuff. I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah.
We hustled so hard those first couple of weeks. And then any opportunity to play that came up, we did it.
Yeah.
And early on, I had a friend who's a pretty successful business guy. He's like, okay, so people are going to ask you to come play and you're going to want to think about it. He's like, don't. He's just go do it.
Yeah, when you're young and when you're new, you just go do it, right?
Exactly. Don't ask about money. Don't worry about that. Just go do it.
Right.
You need to, for a certain period of time, you need to do everything. He's like, when you get so busy that you have to start pick and choosing, that's when you start. But you don't right at first pick and choose. He's like, you go do everything
right.
that comes your way. So we did that in 2006, and we had saved some money. We had a little bit of money in a savings account, and I told Sarah, it's like, if we ever have to dip into that money, I'm going to just get a job. If we ever can't pay a bill and I need to use that money to pay a bill, and we never did, never had to. I mean, we got down to the wire, but I never had to dip into that money. So in 2006, yeah, it's the last time I worked sort of a regular job, and we were just full-time. But, I mean, we were full-time in the sense, like, we would, you know, I was calling everyone I knew, just like, hey, man, if you need anything. I was playing every opportunity, every city I would call venues and play, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were just trying to sell CDs out of the trunk of our car, and that was really great. It sold a lot of CDs off of MySpace, too.
MySpace?
You know, I had my MySpace, yes. And I would get up every morning. Even before I quit my job, I'd get up every morning and add 50 friends on MySpace.
Wow.
You know, and then I found some software that would do it for you, and that was awesome. And yeah, and I had a little order thing on there, and people would order my CD, and every day I'd go to the store and ship out some CDs, you know. And then iTunes came along, and we uploaded to iTunes. And so, yeah, I did that for years. I think I was 06, I think. I signed a record deal at the end of 2009, and then things changed there, you know, and I did a couple albums on a record label, and then I decided to go independent again. Yeah, so, like I said, it's a long story, and there are a lot of little stories in between.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm literally just, like, skimming the
surface
here. So if you have any questions, let me know.
Yeah, I guess what I just really like is that when you look at somebody like you, there's, like, this level of knownness in the world, right? Like people know who you are and all of that stuff. But to hear about the hustle is just like so beautiful to me, right? It's like, that's where that's where like you really see God move, I feel like, in most stories, you know?
Well, we definitely drove across the country to play for like 12 people.
Did you really? I mean, you had like a show and there was 12 people.
Yeah, I mean, we booked a string of shows. Yeah. And I remember those first tours we did with a group and like a lot of nights there was hardly anybody there outside of the people who were traveling with
us. Right,
right. We did a whole tour where I was like, I don't know, maybe one or two nights there were even people who weren't even traveling with us, you know?
Yeah, right.
And we played literally I played on street corners. I played in cow pastures. I played on, you know, the stoop of large buildings outdoors. We played in parks, played in parking lots. I mean, I played pretty much anywhere you can imagine, anywhere a human can be. I mean, played in houses and on patios and on porches and in warehouses and garages. And I have played in garages. I remember playing a show in California. We had 50 people in a garage and it was packed and it was insane. And what's funny is that show, I hear people talk about it a lot. There are only 50 people there, but I've definitely had more than 50 people tell me they were at that show.
Right. Well, I was like,
there's no way you were all there.
Yeah. It was great. Yeah. Yeah. But I guess, so did you make it as a worship leader primarily? Like some of your bigger songs are, there are these sort of worship songs?
Yeah, definitely the bigger songs early on. And still are probably the more like worship songs. But what's funny is if you listen to the records, it's such a, they all have a spiritual conversation.
Yeah, sure, sure.
You know, but the songs people play in church are usually the, like, there's maybe one or two on each record.
Yeah.
I don't have any records where you could even play half of it. Not, I mean, you could do whatever you want in church. I think people should. But, you know, I get the, culturally speaking, there's not even a record where even half of those songs are songs people would play in church. But that's always, I always thought it was funny. That was, those were the songs that became like the big popular songs. I mean, I can't complain at all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's definitely a part of my expression. It's part of what I do, and I'm cool with it. But it is funny. So I think people hear the big worship songs and they come to our shows and they're like, what are you guys doing? Or they did early on. Now they don't. I think they get it now that it's all in there. The worship is there. The stories are there. The rock and roll is there. The whatever else we do. It's all part of the same thing, and it works together. You know, and I think especially these days it works together really, really well. But early on, I think people were confused. They'd invite us to come play at their church. And early on, they'd want to tell me, okay, so what songs are you going to do? I'm going to do these songs. They're like, well, you got to do songs people know. I'm like, I mean, I do whatever I want. Like, I mean, I'm not to be a, no, that sounded terrible.
No, I don't think that sounded terrible.
No, but I mean,
terrible,
but I'm sort of like, no, I'm like, I didn't come all the way out here to like be a jukebox. Like, I love you guys. And so after a while, I had to tell my booking agents, like, you just got to
tell them up front, yeah.
And then after a while, we just didn't do a lot of churches anymore.
Yeah.
Not that I refuse. It's not that it's bad. It's just, it's like, just made more sense outside of that. Sometimes. I mean, and now churches will bring us in. We'll do concerts at the church some, you know, and I'm not against that.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, maybe I'm putting words into your mouth here so you can, like, you know, sort of critique what I'm saying here.
Sure, sure.
But, I feel like worship is so much bigger than these big, amazing ballads,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Like King of My Heart or whatever. Sure. You know, there's these beautiful songs, but worship's so much more than that. It's about worshiping God in all facets of life, mm-hmm. right? It's about even in the questions that we can still worship God as opposed to all these high praise songs all of the time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Well, I kind of think God... I say God wants into every part of life, but that's not true. He already is a part of all of life.
Yeah.
And so not to like, I don't know. I don't want to get so whatever that it's sort of like everything is everything, you know, but it's still, it's sort of like, you know, like there's really not a song. I've always said that like every good song is a worship song. And so it's like, I feel like at one point I wanted to think really hard. Where are the boundaries between what's worship and what isn't? And you really can't find them, you know, because sort of God is part of your story. So even if you're just singing your story, like if you're honest, you know, that's sort of like God's part of it, you know. And I listened to another person's story. Well, like it's sort of the greatest value in the kingdom is people, right?
Yeah.
People are the greatest value. They're what's most important. And so just by listening to your song, even if it's about anything, it's still worship, because by listening to your song, I'm taking part in your story, and I'm valuing you just by listening to your song. By singing along with you, whatever it is you're singing, I'm valuing you even more, because I'm stepping into your story. And so, like, I'm worshiping, even if we're not even talking about God. I mean, we might be talking about breakfast,
yeah,
or what happened on Tuesday. And this isn't a way for me to push God out of the conversation. And more than anything, it's like, no, God is part of that. And sometimes even much more part of that than, like, the sort of explicit, like, we got to have a message. We got to make sure kids hear the message of God. I was like, yeah, but more than anything, I think they need to understand the heart and nature of God, you know?
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, it's like we can give people a checklist, but you know what I think works better is just, like, listening to their story. You know,
bro, I love that. I totally agree.
To
yeah,
me,
totally.
And to me, it's actually a greater form of worship than simply, like, you know, telling God things about himself he already knows.
Yeah, man, I love
you know
that.
What I mean?
I totally agree. Yeah, totally. Yeah. No, I get yeah. that, and I feel like I'm gonna use the word evangelical here, even though I don't know what that means, you know, anymore.
Yeah, me either.
but I feel like in our evangelical culture, we've just pushed God sort of into the margins of our life, right? Where
yeah.
he doesn't mean anything like those other 6 days a week, right? We show up and we worship, and mm-hmm. then where does God show yep. up the rest of the time? And I feel like we've put him in this place where he doesn't matter, and doesn't matter to the entire world
yeah,
or
yeah.
to our world. And so, you know, I feel like getting back into that, like, sort
yeah,
of
yeah.
worship, what worship
totally.
Truly is, you know? is the tricky part, and I feel like worship is just so much bigger
yeah, for sure.
than we give it credit for, you know. It's just it's
yeah,
it's everything.
Absolutely.
It's yeah.
Yeah, totally. And I love blurring the lines between the sacred and the profane, you know. It's just I love it. That's what I live for.
Let's talk about that because I'm totally in on that conversation. I love it. So
yeah.
what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, it's sort of like what is sacred? You know, like, what does that really mean? And I guess we use it to mean, like, what's part of church culture, you know? Like, or, like, depending on the stream you're on, people would say, things that are holy unto the Lord. It's like, but is there anything that's not? You know what I
yeah.
mean?
Yeah, right.
Is there anything God's like, it's like, I really love this. This, I could kind of take it or leave it. I was like, I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it's, I mean, would they call it dualistic thinking? Is that maybe what they would call it, where it's sort of like you have these two kind of lives where there's two sets of value systems.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, this is a sacred song and it must be treated differently than something that's less sacred.
Right.
It's like, but what makes it sacred? Does it mean God's more interested in this song and less interested in this song? It's like, I just don't know.
Yeah.
I really, really don't know. You know, is the way you, is what you do at your job, whether you're like a programmer or you're a janitor or you're a manager or you're an entrepreneur, does what you do, the way you handle yourself, matter less there than it does when you're, you know, at a church function? I don't think so. In fact, I actually think it's the other way around, you know? So it's, you know, do you treat your job as though it's sacred? Do we treat people as though they're sacred? And are those conversations worshipful conversations in the sense that we, you know, treat other people with the sort of respect that they're due because God created them, right? And even when they disagree with us, that's actually better. You know, and if you take the, like, you look at the narrative of the Christ narrative, you know, Christ didn't just die for people who were going to change their minds, right? And sort of, he gave himself for everybody because he values everybody, right? And so, like, we're called to love people whether they join the club or not. Quotations. I just want
there
you
are
to hear the
quotations.
Here.
I can definitely verify
yes.
that. Yeah.
They join the club, you know.
You're right.
We tend to think, like, well, I'm going to love them, but at a point, if they don't get it together, I'm going to... It's like, no. That's
right.
not. It's not our job is to, like... It's not our job to convince people to join the club. It's just our job to treat them with the respect that they deserve because they're made by the Creator, you know.
That's the gospel.
And
that's the gospel
exactly.
there, man. That's
it
the
is,
gospel.
It is. Here's what's really interesting, and I've revisited this Bible verse all my life. I heard this verse, the one about, you know, the be holy as I am holy. And when Jesus quotes that, he says, I can't remember exactly what he said, but he basically quotes it saying the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
He says, so be holy as my Father is holy, you know. But when you look at that context, I always thought, all right, don't look at weird stuff. Like, make sure I, you know, make sure I'm good to my body. Don't, you know, don't do drugs. Don't, you know, like, be, don't do bad things. Don't engage in sinful activities. Right. That's what I always thought that meant. Right. Be holy as I am holy. But that's not at all the context. The context is in this conversation about, like, he's like, you know, my Father causes the sun to shine and the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. You know, essentially, he loves the good and the bad equally. He gives himself to both the good and the bad, and he doesn't give more to one or to the other. He says, so be holy, you know, as my Father, as the Father is holy. So he's actually talking about the way you treat, you know, people. It's like, if you want to be like God, he's like, well, God treats everyone the same. You know, and people would argue, yeah, well, you know, some people die early, but see, God treat, you know, I mean, you know, it's everybody suffers, and good people suffer and bad people suffer. Yeah. Sometimes good people suffer more than bad people, sometimes bad people. And who's good and bad? That's another conversation altogether. But I guess the point is that, like, it's not really you to judge who's good and bad. In a sense, I think obviously there are people that you're like, this guy is, I'm not going to jump in a car with a guy who's driving drunk.
Yeah.
Like, I have to, this is a bad situation.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You may or may not be a bad person to your core. Yeah. I don't know, but I do know this is a bad situation. Yeah. So, like, I'm not saying not to differentiate, but I'm saying, like, you know, God loves people. He gives to all people sun to shine, rain to fall on the just and the unjust. And he doesn't withhold, you know, from either one. And so be holy as I'm holy. I mean, you know, and so I guess in a sense, like, worship, you know, being like God is trying to be kind and to love and make the world better for all types of people, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it's sort of like, and I guess that, you know, a lot of times worship becomes like our, like, fighting anthem. It becomes, you know, our team song. It'd be, you know, like, what is, I mean, I'm, once again, from our earlier conversation, I realize I'm not way into sports. I like sports, but I just don't know much about sports. You know, but college teams all have their songs.
Yeah, right.
For their team, you know, like, and, you know, you go to a, my family's all from Georgia. You go to a Georgia game, and they're going to sing Who Let the Dogs Out.
Dude, everybody's SEC, yeah, for sure.
Right? Who Let the Dogs Out.
Yeah.
Right? Well, we treat worship like Who Let the Dogs Out. It's sort of like our, this is our song. This is our team songs, you know.
Yeah.
We're going to make the name of Jesus famous.
Right.
Right. Right. Because we're going to make our team awesome. We're going to make sure everyone knows how powerful our team is. Right.
Yeah.
And worship becomes this thing that I don't think it was ever intended to be.
Yeah.
You know, and it becomes a, it becomes much more of a tribal expression. Right.
Right.
Sort of an expression of the value, where you value the tribe, you value the club, which in itself isn't bad, I guess, but it's sort of like, I think the bigger conversation is, how do we value everybody?
Yeah, right. And we have these certain set of principles, I mean, and rules that, like, if you obey these rules, then you could be part of the club too, you know? And if you do things that sort of I'm comfortable with, that, you know, you're allowed in. And if not, well, then, you know, screw you or whatever.
Exactly. And maybe you're just not in the club, but, like, what's your Monday through Friday, Monday through Saturday, you know, do you... I don't know. This is worth thinking about.
Yeah, right, man. That's exactly the whole podcast. Yeah, yeah. That's the theology of hustle, right?
Yeah.
It's where are you bringing God into every single day? You know?
Yeah, totally. Well, I guess that's the point. Jesus says, like, it's easy to love people like you.
Right.
Yeah, I think he says, he's like, there's not really any reward for that.
Everybody
you know?
Can do
like,
that.
So, like, exactly. So your evangelical buddy, you know, who you go to church with, who believes all the same stuff you believe, like, your family, even, like, say, loving them is like, there's not much of a reward for that.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. If you don't love your family, it's, you're, it's not going to go well.
Yeah, right.
It's not a good,
right.
It's not what, that's, I don't think that's the point. But what he's saying is, like, that's easy. He's like, the reward is the way you love the people who are not like you. That's where the reward is, right?
Yeah.
You know, so how does this all enter into worship? I think it all is part of worship.
Yes.
And I think it, like, and that's the whole issue with sacred and profane is, like, you're going to cut, all of a sudden there's the cutoff here, you know. Oh, cutoff. that's not a worship song. I was like, yeah, but that person is really feeling something that's real important to them. I need to listen to it because I feel the same way. I don't know them, but I'm entering into some sort of fellowship with this person, and that's worship because I see them and I see people like them. And I have compassion on those people, right?
Yeah.
I enter into like gangster rap. Like, you know, there's a lot of foul language. It's like, and I wouldn't encourage a lot of young people to get, especially, I feel like it was worse when we were younger.
It was. And I'm a big gangster rap fan. Yeah,
me too.
To be honest
me
with
too.
You.
Me too.
Are you really?
Yeah, I'm a huge gangster rap fan. That's what I listened to in junior high. Yes, totally. Oh, I was all West
awesome.
Coast. I don't know. East Coast, West Coast.
I was dirty South, actually. So,
okay, all right, all right. How old are you?
So I'm 35.
35, okay. For me, the South was not represented in the mid-90s when I was went. It's not incredibly
I'm thinking more like Houston rappers. Like,
oh, I
got
you. Yeah.
Like Andre 3000.
Okay, yeah.
Outkast. Outkast is sort of this dirty South thing in my mind. Yeah, for sure.
But what's interesting, I'm thinking like, I mean, you know, NWA and... You know, the Death Row and... But what's interesting, and it does glorify things that I don't think need to be glorified. Yeah. But if you think about it for a minute, like, why was this such a big thing, you know? And it's because there are people who, you know, who don't trust the police,
right.
You know? And why do you want to be part of a gang? Like, being part of a gang, like, makes you feel somewhat protected. You feel part of a, you know, you feel like you have a family, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, if you look at the roots of it and you look at the undertones and you look at where it came, why it is such a thing, you're like, you will see people.
Yeah.
There's something happening that made this such a huge thing.
Yes.
Right? There's something going on.
Yes.
And, like, so,
yes.
You know, so let's not just, you know, I get it. The way they talk about women is terrible. The singing about, I mean, you know, glorifying violence is terrible. But, like, there's something beneath it that's worth considering. And by seeing the people there and having compassion on the people, like, there's worship in that.
Yeah. Dude.
You know, even though.
Dude, we are going to have to nerd out about rap sometime. That's awesome.
Yep. But that's why you can't just draw a line between sacred and profane. You know, there's something sacred beneath all that profanity.
Yeah.
There's something going on. And the sacredness is the people, right?
Yeah.
Is the story of the people is a sacred thing. And you can't always remove it. That's why you got to see through it, you know, even literal profanity, you know.
Yeah.
There's something happening there that I think is really important to see.
Yeah, dude, totally. I'm down with Luther's theology, so I'm down with the profane language, you know. Profane language for profane circumstances is my saying. So I've listened to your typology podcast. I dabble in the Enneagram a little bit, and so I heard from that you're a four. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay. So, big for a four is sort of this authenticity. And so how do you bring authenticity into your music? I would imagine you can't really make music that is inauthentic. Is that true?
Yeah.
So how do you bring those together?
I mean, this is just the way I feel about it. And I thought this is the way most people felt about it. And I realized, and that's one beauty of the Enneagram, is like, oh, wait, I'm different. There are different types of people
right.
who think different ways. And all of them can be valuable, right? Because
yeah.
early on, I was like, I'm not feeling that song. So I would it's trash. Toss it. I mean, literally, I would feel that way, you know?
Yeah.
And I realized, well, I guess people approach these things for different reasons. And just because I approach a song because I want to feel something. I want to feel like I'm hearing something that someone really cares about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, but other people might not, and that's fine. You know, I shouldn't throw them out.
Yeah.
Toss their story out just because I don't feel like they're being completely honest.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe that isn't really what they're trying to do anyway. So, that's the thing of, I don't feel like they're being completely honest. Well, how so pious, you know. But yeah, so early on though, like to me, what was sacred was the honesty, you know.
Yeah.
And so like the authenticity, to me it was even interesting when people started talking about authenticity. I was like, what does that mean? I was like, do you mean people are try to write songs that they don't really care about, you know? I mean, I felt like most people try to write something about what they care about. But I think what it comes down to is believability is really what they're trying to say, is believability. I mean, and it's not for everyone. I'm sure some people hear my music are like, oh, this is total BS. But You know, but there are obviously people who hear it, and I've somehow what I'm doing is believable, and I think it's because I try and believe it myself.
Yeah.
You know, like, does an idea make me emotional? Do I feel it deep down? It's like, okay, that's something worth writing. And I'd write songs, and I wouldn't feel anything. I'd be like, I just can't even sing it. And honestly, that's why I couldn't. That's why I never went into the worship leader field. Huh. You know, is because I just couldn't sing other people's songs. Like, there's good songs. It's like, I just can't sing a song. I can hardly sing a song I didn't write.
Really?
Like, because I just don't feel it. Yeah, and it'd be like, we need... And you're, like, singing the same people every week, so you got to have new songs. It's like, I just can't do it. I know that sounds so terrible, and I would feel bad about it. I'm like, this isn't me. Huh. Like, I can't sing a song. It's like, I'm going to have to change the lyrics. I'm going to have to do something different. I don't feel this. It's not even that I disagree.
Yeah,
it's
just, right.
But that was me, you know, and I realized that's weird. So, I mean, I had offers to go. There was big churches that were like, listen, we'll pay you. And it'd be like a nice salary to play two weekends a month. And they're like, you don't even have to move here. We'll fly you in, you know. But you got to do this, this, and this. And it's like, oh, are you for real? I'm just sorry, guys. I can't do it. I just can't. And it's not because I'm being a jerk.
Yeah. Right?
I just, you know. I just can't do it. It's hard. It's hard to sing somebody else's song unless I can somehow find myself in it.
Yeah, totally.
You know.
So I'm a three, and because as a three, I don't really have emotions or don't even really sort of know what they are. But because of your fourness and your authenticity with your emotions, I feel like it sort of shows me what emotions are, and I highly value that. But I could definitely see how that could get you into some trouble. I'm sure people are like, what the heck is he even talking about? He can't play other people's songs. What a diva. You know what I mean?
Like, I know, for real.
Yeah. But like... Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, but I definitely want to get a chance to talk about the Christmas album, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's coming out. So is it a Christmas album or Advent album? Or?
I guess we're calling it a Christmas album. You can call it either way. Yeah, I didn't put any Christmas language in the title, so yeah.
Yeah, well, that was my big question, because this is like sort of your first like Christmas, you know, Advent album, right? Okay, so I guess I'll set this up in my mind. I guess there is no more deeply ingrained genre of music in the world than Christmas music. You know, people who even don't even, you know, sort of have a care for God know Christmas songs and can sort of sing the classic Christmas hymns. You know, it's just...
Totally, yep.
It's ingrained in who we are. So why are you creating a Christmas album? Why did you create a Christmas album? What's the reasoning behind all this?
Yeah, totally. Well, you know, so every year or so, things slow down for me around Christmas. And I'm really terrible about when things slow down, I always find myself things to do. And a lot of times I'll give myself way too much work, and I'll be busier on the slow season than I am on the busy season. So every year things would slow down around Thanksgiving, and I'd have a couple of days of kind of vacation, and I'd be like, man, what's going on? And vacation is dangerous for me because I dream, you know? I'm like, oh, man, I could do this. So I come out of the vacation with, like, things to do. And so almost every year I'd call my buddy Everett, lives up in the mountains. He's a producer and he's a string arranger. I'd be like, hey, Everett, let's do a Christmas song. I was like, I need something to do. So a few years in a row I did Christmas songs with Everett, and we gave them away. And so over time, I was like, man, these songs aren't anywhere. They're not on Spotify. They're not on iTunes. They're not, they may be on YouTube. I was like, but, you know, but we'd literally do it in a day. It'd sound like a cool demo, but, you know, we'd literally knock it out in a whole day and we'd give it away. And so after a while, everyone was like, you know, we really need to compile a lot of these and make a record out of them. I was like, we really should. And so finally, I was like, all right, Everett, this is the year. No, what happened was Everett and I were working on the Sessions records. Everett produced those with all the strings. It's like, Everett, this is so much fun. I don't want to stop working. You know? Instead of stopping, let's just make a Christmas record. So we did. We just kept on going and kept, you know, made a Christmas record, did some cover songs. And I don't think I actually sat down and wrote a song, one single song for this record. It's all stuff I'd had that I was just waiting for an opportunity to use. But then we recorded it all. Recorded some covers like What a Wonderful World and Make You Feel My Love is not a Christmas song, but it always sounded like one to me, the lyrics. And, you know, I go hungry, I go black and blue, I go crawling down the avenue. there's nothing that I wouldn't do to make you feel my love. It's like, oh, that's so Christmas to me. You know, that's the Advent to me in a like.
Well, that's the God with us right there, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's beautiful. Yeah. And so we just had fun. We just had a Christmas party and, you know, we did a couple of days at a studio in the mountains, and then Everett just sort of took over from there. And then I did vocals at the house and he'd come down and we'd track in my basement. And so that's sort of how it happened. It's something we've wanted to do for a long time. And finally I was like, this is the year to do it.
Yeah, for sure, man. I've really enjoyed. There's the one song out on YouTube, right? That you've released.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the baby son.
Oh yeah, your baby son. I've really enjoyed it. It's got a great feel to it. I'm really excited about the album. Yeah, for sure. So was it like a total trip to release something like that, or what is it like to release a Christmas album?
It's interesting because you can only sell Christmas music for like 6 weeks out of the year.
Right.
So the idea is like, okay, but hopefully some of these songs will end up in people's sort of classic playlists in their mind and on their computer. But, you know, in their mind, like, I was like, I think it'd be really cool to like, you know, someone listens to Baby Son every year, you know. But in the meantime, we have to like try and get people to stream it as much as possible in 6 weeks and then nothing until next year. So that I was like, oh, wow, this is an interesting challenge. It's like, I hope people don't get tired of hearing about this because I'm going to talk about it every day for the next 6 weeks. But at the same time, that's what Christmas is. Just like, media, advertising, you know, ads, stuff, buy, spin, music.
Right.
So I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to add my voice to the mix this year. Shotgun, or not, machine gun.
Yeah, right.
Christmas. Yeah, we'll just see how it goes. Yeah, but it's a lot of fun. Maybe next year I'll do a Christmas tour. I think that'd be a lot of fun. We can't do it this year. I was too busy to make it happen.
Yeah, so. Well, you went all out. I saw the vinyl pressings for that album, man. That is seriously legit.
Yeah. In fact, I hope those arrive this week. I'm really stoked to see those. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and like your wife made ornaments to go with them. Is that right?
She did. Yeah. She does pottery. Last year for Christmas, she put some... She's done pottery for years, and she had... let it go when we had the kids just because it was very time intensive. But as the kids have gone to school, she's had some time. She started doing it again. So last year she put some up on a website around Christmas time and she sold out in under 24 hours.
Wow.
So this year I was like, all right, babe, you need to do more. I was like, you know, it'd be really cool. I think our crowd would like it if you did some sort of ornament. Because we always try and have some sort of package. You get the vinyl and then you get like the mega package with the shirt. And it's like, who wants a Christmas t-shirt? I don't know. Maybe I could have done a weird sweater maybe next year an adult onesie, you know, but.
Dude, I'm always in for that.
I was like,
for
people obviously like your pottery, so let's do that. Yeah. And at this point, we've probably sold all of those packages because she can only do 100 because it takes so long that she made 120 so that, you know, because if they break, we have to have some to replace. So.
Right.
But they take a long time, so like we wouldn't be able to have more before Christmas.
Yeah, but I love the whole thing, man. I'm just I'm really excited about just the newness. You know, it can be so tough, right? Sometimes, like especially even with my kids, like bringing them into the true meaning of the Advent season is so tough, man. It's like with all the commercialism and you know all the you know stuff going on, it's so hard to like show them the, you know, this is why we're truly celebrating this, and Christmas songs can get so, you know, like sort of mundane, right? And so I'm excited for some freshness, you know.
Well, thank you.
So let's jump into my final two questions. So what is the strangest job you have ever had?
The strangest job. So this job doesn't sound too strange, but I had to do some strange things on this job. And I guess it's only strange because most people don't realize someone has to do this. But I worked construction one summer, and with a company that builds big hotel chains.
Yeah.
So I mean, there's like hundreds of people in and out. You know, as you start from the foundation and you frame it up, and then the sheetrock and the insulation, and then it's just unreal. Just see the whole thing come
together. Right.
You know, they put the tubs in before the plumbing is in. At least before they turn the plumbing on. And then before they, you know, they do the concrete and then they'll do the sheetrock and you scrape the floor so they can put the thing down and put the carpet down. So before they're ready to carpet the rooms, you know, sort of one of the last stages, carpet the rooms, someone has to go through. See, so people don't, you know, there's like 100 people, could be any day, there could be maybe 100 people on the deal, you know, minimum of 20 people, right?
Yeah.
And there's one port-a-john, and a lot of times guys don't like to walk down and use the port-a-john, so they just go in the bathtub, right? And so... This is not, I mean, this is common. If you're in construction, yeah, this is like, But people look at me like, are you kidding me? I'm like, this is normal.
Yeah, you got to do what you got to do, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But so someone has to, before they turn the plumbing on and before they put the carpet down, because they don't want you, like, someone has to clean those tubs out. And usually it's like, it's not like the tub's full of poop. It's like someone has pooped and then when they're clearing the rooms, they just throw crap out of the way to whatever it is they're working on. So it's usually like, there's crap at the bottom. There's pee on top of that, you know, and then there's like insulation, sheetrock, any other types of materials and things that were needed to be moved out of the way or thrown away. A lot of times they're in there. So someone's got to dig that stuff out.
No.
Carry it out and then clean the,
yeah. That's what you did?
That was me. That was me. I had to do that. And I was like, can I have some gloves or something? And they handed me these two disposable latex gloves. I put my hands in, I have big hands, and immediately they split, you know, right here between the fingers. I was like, oh my gosh.
Whoa.
So what I did is I took two plastic bags, two trash bags, and wrapped them around my hands and then duct tape, right?
Went in. Oh, man. That is amazing. That's up there for the strangest jobs
on this
podcast.
That's one of the strangest
podcast.
Things that I've ever done.
I love that, man. I love that. Thanks for being willing to share that.
Well, sure. Yeah, no problem. I think nothing is more strange than touring, though.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. Yes,
sleeping in weird places and waking up in weird places. And
all with a bunch of people with you nonstop.
Nonstop,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is crazy, especially for an introvert. I bet that's some serious
stuff.
I'm
actually funny. I'm an Enneagram 4, but I'm... oddly extrovert.
Oh, so you're an extrovert. Yeah, yeah. Yes, I bet that helps a ton, right? On the road.
It does. Most people couldn't do what I do.
Yeah, yeah. No doubt.
Extrovert.
No
yeah.
doubt. Okay, so finally, what is one piece of advice you would give to people looking to bring the kingdom of God into their work?
Oh, man. I think, man, just think about people. The older I get, the more I realize like a lot of this, it's not stuff you can do on your own, you know? It's stuff that has to happen to you, you know? But I think, like, ask yourself, you know, like, early on, someone would do something that made me mad, I would just respond in anger. Now I'm like, why did they do that?
Right.
Why did they do that? You know, like, someone cuts you off in traffic, it's easy to just be like, that person is terrible, I hope they wreck, and hope they die. But, like, did their mom
right.
just die? Did they just lose a child?
Yeah.
Did they just get divorced? Like, maybe they're just having a bad day. You know,
right.
like,
right.
you're like, I wasn't mature enough to see that deep. Like, maybe they are just being terrible. It's like, but you know, like, there's a reason. Nobody hurts other people for no reason.
Right. You're right.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think they may not know why they're doing it, but it's like, hurt people hurt people.
Yeah.
You know? And so, like, being able to just, I think if you want to, if you want to see people differently, and that's what the kingdom of God is all about, is the way you see other people, is learning to see people the way God sees people, you know? And the beauty is the way God sees people is he sees all of their pain, you know?
Yeah.
He doesn't just see a jerk, someone who's mean and rude. He doesn't even a person who abuses someone else. He doesn't just see an abuser. He sees a person who's been abused, you know, who is just continuing the cycle, who's acting out, you know? So it's hard. It's actually a really hard thing. I think it'll be the hardest thing we ever do is over time learning to see people differently. I mean, you know, I know that's so heavy.
Oh man. Yeah. And I think it takes a lot of maturity to see people, mm-hmm. you know, that way.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, even at the very least, like I want to walk out on the stage and look at that crowd. And I want to be, oh my gosh, you just want to like, I'm not just here to play songs for you so you can pay me money. I'm not even just here to play songs for you because they're going to make you better people. Like, I want to walk out and be like, oh, look at all these people.
Yeah.
You know, and some nights I do, I'll walk out and I'm just like, gosh, these people are so sweet.
Yeah.
I was like, man, God loves these people so much. It's just so awesome to walk out and look at them. You know
Amen,
what I mean?
Man. Yeah, dude, I totally agree.
To me, that's what
agree.
It's about.
Yeah.
You know?
For sure. Yeah, yeah. That's awesome. Good stuff. All right. Well, thanks so much for making time for me, man. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, thank you.
Dude, this was a ton of fun. And maybe we'll catch each other around sometime, you know?
So, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, man.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, man. Right.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from John Mark. It's just so cool to talk to somebody about their creative process and how all that goes down. And he's just a cool guy. I promise if we ever get together and talk about gangster rap for a more lengthy period of time, I will record that. That is my promise to you. So do me a favor, get out there and share this episode. Shout it from the rooftops. Let people know that it's out there. Check it out yourself and make sure and get the word out for John Mark. It's a lot of fun. I think it's cool supporting artists like this. So let's all do our part for that. I love hearing from you, so make sure you let me know what you think. And until next time, get out there and hustle.